This episode is brought to you by Kitchens Confidential, helping restaurants strive and thrive in a takeout-driven market. This week on Meat and Three, we look at how delivery went from convenience to crucial.
In a pre-COVID universe, the commissions from these third-party delivery service providers were really high, and you were seeing oftentimes they were as high as 30%, right?
I mean, all food is about basically the history of money and the history of technological change, but takeout in particular.
I'll go ring a doorbell and watch somebody come outside and wipe down their door and their doorbell after I leave. It's kind of creepy, kind of weird, but that's the state of where we are now.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. We're recording remotely, and it's Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. One of our favorite guests over the years has been British author Pete Brown. I've followed his books on cider and beer, and he came up with a new book during the COVID quarantine that I think we've all been wanting to read and talk about for a while, and I'm glad he wrote this book. So let's just take a minute and have each guest introduce themselves, and we'll start the conversation. Pete?
My name's Pete Brown. I'm a writer based in London, England.
Great. Stephen?
My name's Steve Beaumont. I'm also a writer, but I'm based in Toronto, Canada.
And BR?
And I'm BR Rolio, Shelton Brothers Importers, based in New York City.
Okay. So, Pete, just bring us up to speed on the book. You know, I know you gave a talk about it last year. Why did you write this book? What's the general premise?
Originally, I started writing it to wind people up and to piss people off, and it kind of grew out of that, really. I've been obsessed, like I think probably a lot of people have, with the debate over the meaning of craft beer. And even though I've never thought there was a satisfactory outcome, I got more frustrated with the people who said, well, because there isn't a satisfactory definition, that means it doesn't exist, that means it's not a thing. And I was thinking about that in the back of my mind for years, and then I found a book a couple of years ago that talked about craft in its broad sense, but not in relation to craft beer. And when I started reading that and reading about broader notions of craft, and I said, well, how does this word craft fit in? If we put beer to one side for a minute and think about what craft is, and then once we've analysed that and learned about that, if we then come back to beer from that perspective, what does that teach us? And so the book was an example to do that, really. And in the end, I'm sure it's still going to piss a few people off, but that's no longer my main intention.
Yeah, you definitely start by almost breaking down craft, and then you build it up again with your own, you know, really good argument. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And Stephen, the reason I invited you to the show is we saw you were mentioned in the acknowledgments, and you also are quoted on the inside cover.
Yeah. Well, Pete sent me an advanced copy of the book to, you know, he was very open about it. Said, no pressure, but if there's anything you'd like to say, I'd love to hear it. I got a couple of clangers in the editing process that hadn't been done yet, so I sent those off to Pete, and then I finished reading it, and I was quite impressed by the whole thing, and it actually, the quote that I gave references his book, Hops and Glory, where, you know, he did the insane thing of taking a cask of ale all the way to India. And I thought I made the parallel of this as kind of the literary equivalent of this kind of heavy liftings, making this voyage, starting from craft and then going through to, you know, what really does this mean when applied to beer? It's a fun book.
That's great. And Pete, you know, you definitely have some great resources in the book. I know you reference Garrett Oliver. You also reference importer Dan Shelton. How did you know, start us with the book, the research process? We know we've all talked about what craft beer means. There's different definitions. There's the Brewers Association, but tell us the meat of the book and how you really got into it.
So in the first section of the book, I look at all the definitions that have been around for a while. I start with Vince Catone's definition from 1986, and I unfairly whip that to death. It's not his fault. You know, craft became a bigger thing than the thing he was defining in the early 80s, mid-80s. Then I move on to the Brewers Association definition and show how that is not fit for purpose. And then move on to a definition that I found that was written by Dan Shelton in about 2009 that I found in an old copy of a Belgian beer guide. And none of these are fit for purpose because you can't find something which is both measurable and meaningful and flexible enough to work for what craft beer is. So it's kind of, okay, should we just give up now? Maybe I should have done. But what I did instead was look at so this idea of craft as we think of it, irrespective of beer, goes back to around the late 19th century and the birth of the arts and crafts movement, when you have the big industrialization of work and the separation of the labor that people put into work from the results of their labor. So work becomes something that's very kind of oppressive, and people don't get a chance to kind of have any say in what they do with their work. And this idea of craft was quite a naive movement, but a very influential movement to try and get that back. And so I look at that quite a lot. And reading stuff that, by the way, I've never read before, I've not looked at this before, so it was all new to me when I was doing the reading. And it brought me around to quite a different place in terms of how I thought about craft beer.
Okay. One part of that is, does craft have to have, you know, artisan, is it? Does it have to be handcrafted?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one, isn't it? Because that's the first thing that people think. They say, well, it's handmade, it's handcrafted, that's what craft is. That's what a lot of definitions of craft outside beer kind of relate to. And it's a very, what's the word? Yeah, it's a very limiting definition if you stick to that. And I talk about... I start with talking about a sparging arm in a mash tun and say, as soon as you've got that in, it's not technically handcrafted anymore because that's a machine doing a job that a human can do. And that's a really pedantic point. The book's full of really pedantic points. But if you allow a sparging arm, do you then allow a self-cleaning mash tun? If you allow that, do you then allow, automated brewery systems? And the more you allow, the more you get away from this idea of handcrafted, but is it still craft beer? And I think by the end of it, I say, well, it kind of is. Handcrafted is a lovely thing to have, but craft is more about the intent and the ownership. If a brewer is fully in charge of the process and brewing the beer that they want to brew and using the level of technology and equipment that they want to use, then my argument is that it's still a craft beer, even if the entire brewing process is fully enclosed.
Many years ago, we did a show about, we were trying to split the definition between contract brewed beers and gypsy brewers. And everyone seemed to think at the time that gypsy brewers were cool, but contract brewing wasn't. Stephen, following this, the craft, you know, argument, what are some, you know, topics that have come up or you'd like to mention?
Well, you know, Jimmy, I'm glad you bring up the whole contract brewing thing. I think the movement now is to stop talking about gypsy brewing and more nomadic brewing, or however you want to phrase it. And there's this sense that if you don't have skin in the game, if you're not paying money to have equipment, that somehow your beer is not as worthy. Which to me is a little bizarre, because, you know, anyone who has a lot of money can buy equipment. It doesn't mean that you're committing your life to beer if you have an extra couple million in the bank and you go, okay, I'm going to use 750,000 of this to buy a brewery. What makes the difference is dedication to creating some great beers. And I think there are contract brewers who just have, you know, an idea of a great brand, and yes, I want to build this brand, and I don't really care what it tastes like. And then there are contract brewers who just really do care about what they're putting out. They want to make the best beer they possibly can. And a lot of those people, once they get a little capital behind them, they go on and they do open their own brewery. I mean, you look at the example of New Zealand, and the New Zealand brewing industry would be probably half of what it is today if they hadn't had contract brewing over there.
Wow, that's great. And you travel a lot. Have you curtailed your traveling because of the pandemic?
I have not. I got back like 2 days before lockdown here in Toronto in March, and I haven't been anywhere since, and it's killing me.
Well, in Toronto, I know B.R. Roy, also, we're friendly with Godspeed. That was Luke, formerly of Due to Seattle. And you said that you might be drinking a Godspeed beer today?
I am drinking an Ikinuki from Godspeed right now. It's his homage to Bamberg. It's a Keller beer, and he says his inspiration is the Ungerspundet from Mar beer, but he adds a little smoked malt to it, so it's a really lovely smoked Keller beer.
Oh, that's great.
That's nothing to do with Godspeed the band, is it?
No. Luke is a Quebecois brewer who came to Toronto via Japan. And he has this great affection for all things Japanese, except for their beer styles.
Although he is from his time in Montreal, is friends with the Godspeed band folks. And we were talking when Godspeed was playing a show in Brooklyn, and we were hoping ideally to have a collaboration brew that they would do to release here in the U.S. During both a launch of Godspeed the brewery after the show, but that unfortunately never came to pass.
That would be so cool. Their music is just like the music of 2020, basically. It's so doom-laden and apocalyptic. It's
definitely.
Well, and since BR is on, I know that Pete references Dan Shelton and his kind of, I call it the Shelton seal of approval, but how would you describe, because you rep so many of the Shelton beers, how would you describe the Shelton ethos for selecting beer? And do you call it your beer good beer or craft beer?
I think we just call it beer. Essentially, the aesthetic is beers that we like to drink. You know, there's not initially when the company first started out, before I was with the company, it was, you know, focusing primarily on classic styles from Belgium and Germany. And England, things that, you know, sort of the best examples of a British IPA or the best example of a Keller beer, obviously have since branched out from that. But it still has to be, you know, we want to work, you know, the company, we want to have people, brewers who we respect, brewers who we agree with their philosophy of, you know, not necessarily rushing things, taking their time, making quality products. You know, whether it's a contract brew, whether it is a gypsy nomadic brew, or whether it's, you know, someone like Mars who's been doing it for hundreds of years in the family.
Great. And then back to Pete, to your book. My first question is, does size matter? You know, I think that for a while people wanted to call this beer microbrewed. You dive into that a lot in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the first definition of craft beer was to get away from the idea that it was microbrewed. And then the first clause in the first definition of craft beer was about size, saying that it was small. And one problem with that is that small is highly subjective. You know, what is small in the United States is pretty huge here in the UK. And the second problem with that is that it penalizes success. It penalizes growth. And I touch on... you know, the furore around when the Brewers Association changed its definition from 2 million barrels to 6 million barrels to accommodate Sam Adams' growth. And they didn't really have a choice other than to do that, because if they hadn't done that, then come the next kind of auditing of market figures, Sam Adams' volume would have been subtracted from the craft column and entered into the macro column. And then people would have been able to say, hey, look, craft beer has slumped by 2 million barrels this year. The craft boom is over. When in fact, what happened was craft grew so much that you had to kind of look at redefining it. So I think that is a real problem. I think a common theme through the book is that if you take something like size, it's usually small. It's often small. As soon as you say small is a precondition, then you have to start kind of excluding people you don't want to exclude.
And then there's one more area of the book that I liked. You seem that you say that American kind of defined what craft beer is, IPAs and everything. And how was it seen in England? Because you already had traditional beers in England.
It's one of the biggest, for people like me who've been around for a little while, it's one of the biggest frustrations imaginable in that for here, for a lot of people who drink craft beer here, craft beer is American. It is super hoppy. It's hazy. You know, there are people who say, oh, this beer is not craft beer because I can see through it. But it's an American beer style. It's got a young countercultural attitude. And I'm not criticizing any of these elements at all. I think they're all great things. But then they turn around to British beer and say, well, this is not craft beer. And you go, well, it's brewed with traditional ingredients. It's brewed in small batches. It's brewed on a local basis. It's true to traditional beer styles. How is this not craft beer? And it's like, well, because it's an old guy brewing it. Yeah, like, well, that's not right. Or, well, because it's fairly bland, or because I don't like the taste of it. It's like, well, I've tasted some pretty sucky craft beers produced by young hip guys, you know. I've been talking to years for people in the first wave of American craft brewing who say we took our inspiration from British cask ale. So how can British cask ale not be craft beer if the beers that it inspired are craft beer? And that's a very local problem that we have in the UK. But I guess it's also a problem in Germany, where people wouldn't maybe count, young German drinkers wouldn't count some traditional, you know, Kellerpils or Rauch beer as craft beer, because it's just been around for ages. It's boring. And you look at Belgium and you think, what, are we going to say that Trappist beers and Abbey beers aren't craft beer because they've been around for, you know, 100 years or so? That's incredible. You know, they're some of the finest craft beers in the world.
Can I jump in for a second, Jimmy?
Go, Steve.
As you know, I'm the co-author of the World Atlas of Beer, and Tim Webb and I have the third edition of that coming out this fall. Unfortunately, only in the UK to start. It won't be in the US until next year. But Tim, being based in England, he makes the case that possibly the first craft brewery of the modern era is actually Trek Airhouse in Scotland, where they, you know, put a brewery into this oldest inhabited house in Scotland. They stuck a brewery into it, and this goes back to the 60s, where they started making, you know, these old style Scottish ales, and Tracare House Ale is still around today. And he says, you know, maybe that was the first craft beer of modern times.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And I was going to ask Bjorg, back to the talking about the Shelton Brother beers, you know, how does tradition play into it? And does size, do you limit your beers based on the size of the brewery?
We tend to limit based on size simply because of the distribution network and what we can do. I mean, I don't think it's not necessarily that we don't want a larger brewery, but we also want to expose smaller breweries that might not otherwise get attention. You know, I mean, there's, you know, no need to, for example, take someone the size of Sam Adams or something. You know, they don't need the exposure. So, and this day and age, a lot of the larger breweries, you know, already have working on their own representation and marketing. So we like to keep it small. You know, and it can be an old brewery, it can be a new brewery. We love the traditional styles, and you know, a lot of those were in danger of being forgotten or overlooked because, as Pete was saying, people just found them boring. You know, but we find a lot of those beers delightful, and there's a reason why they've been around for hundreds of years. But it's also fun to see the new scenes that are happening, say, in Scandinavia, using a lot of local ingredients. So, you know, we prefer the smaller ones, but it's not a hard and fast rule.
Yeah. And Pete, back to your book, what is Michael Jackson, what did he say about the early days of craft beer?
Well, it's like everything else, isn't it? You think other people have created something interesting and new, and you dig into it, and it turns out that Michael did it first. Michael, in his World Guide to Beer, talked about craft brewed beers, and he didn't define what they were. And this is really interesting because Jackson defined a lot of things in beer. You know, he was the first person to have a go at doing beer styles and putting definitions around various different aspects of beer. And he just said, this is a crafted beer, this is a craft brewed beer, and this is a craft brewery. Belgian breweries in particular and French breweries and a couple of American breweries. And my suspicion is that what he was trying to do with language was to try to tell a British readership that there were really interesting beer styles that had integrity and tradition that were not British cask conditioned real ale. Because at the time he was writing, good beer was cask ale and everything else was terrible, and which was obviously such a wrong headed view of the world, but he was the first guy writing about beer to explore that and to bring that to life. So that's my hunch as to why he talked about craft beer. He certainly did try and define it, and I'm sure he would have been quite bemused by what it's turned into.
And Stephen, you know, with the World Atlas of Beer, I feel like you guys, you and Tim, have kind of taken what Michael Jackson did. Do you want to keep talking about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, with the first edition back in 2012, we felt a huge amount of personal pressure because Tim and I were both friends of Michael's. We both had a great sense of history in what we were taking on with the World Atlas of Beer. And even for the same publisher that he used for his World Guide to Beer. So we felt a lot of kind of historic pressure to come up with something that would have made Michael proud. And we felt that we did. And then the second edition, we felt we did a little better. And for this third edition, we've actually rewritten the entire thing cover to cover. And we're pretty confident that it's the most comprehensive book on what's going on in the world. We even managed to sneak in some updates to the COVID era just before it was going to presses. So we've got as modern as we possibly could on this one.
Was there anything that surprised you in writing this book? Any new brewery or?
Oh, God, Jimmy.
New phenomenon.
At this stage, almost everything surprises me and nothing surprises me at the same time. you know, I mentioned I got back 2 days before lockdown happened in Toronto. I was down in Brazil, and I was drinking these astounding Brazilian beers. And this is a young, young craft beer market down there. And yet they're doing things that are so exciting, so innovative. I think I probably mentioned it in the book. Latin America as a whole is the most exciting place for beer in the world today. The Latin American brewers are just taking things and making that their own. It's really, really thrilling down there. I'm constantly running into new breweries. I mean, if you start saying, oh, specifically this brewery or that brewery, there's just no stopping. Because, you know, we figure somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 breweries in the world today, plus or minus.
That's great. And Pete, back to you. So talking about traditions versus, you know, it's like cask ale versus industrial beer. You know, is craft beer something that has to come in a can now? I remember when 15, 20 years ago, I think that we all thought that craft beer had to be on draft. And there were people that were passing off, you know, commercial beers as craft by putting it in draft. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of my pet hates, really, is that a lot of people into craft. So I think it's probably too simplistic to try and say it splits into two people, because it two kinds of people, because it definitely doesn't. It splits into quite a lot of different types of people. But we have, I think, beer lovers who know beer styles, who recognize different beer traditions around the world, who are excited by new flavors, who like to explore different traditions. And I'm talking about, you know, someone who might drink a Keller beer one day, a Belgian Trappist the next day, a New England IPA the next day, and evaluate each on its merits. And then we have people for whom craft beer is a scene. It's fashionable. It's something to be. It's a part of self-definition. It's like I keep saying that craft beer is a cultural product as much as it is a food and drink product. And to those people, craft beer is whatever is new, it's whatever is interesting. And cans have made craft beer a lot more interesting because they've made it, they've really amped up the cultural product side of craft beer. Craft beer, I'm currently writing a book about beer design and looking at... it's kind of about 70% craft cans. And I started off thinking about how a lot of these cans are very interesting, they're very impactful, but they kind of get lost on a shelf amid this visual noise. And then realized when I was researching the book and talking to brewers, these beers don't get shown on shelf. They get shown on Instagram. And the label gets rolled out and you see the whole canvas. And this is about saying, look at this cool artist we're working with. Look at this this great design that we've got. And it's like, well, what's the beer style? Oh, hang on a minute. Let me go and check.
Well, that's a really good point. Hey, let's just take a short break. We're going to be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Kitchens Confidential, helping restaurants strive and thrive in a takeout-driven market. Whether you're a restaurant with a single location, a food truck, or a chef looking to expand, Kitchens Confidential can help you get your delivery and pickup-only kitchen up and running in a matter of days. They provide turnkey kitchen space, a state-of-the-art experience hub for pickup orders, and they'll even help you manage and streamline your back-office functions using their proprietary technology platform, so you can focus on what you love the most, making great food. Kitchens Confidential, to go crafted. Learn more at kitchensconfidential.com.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Please support us, heritageradionetwork.org, become a member, and keep us on the air. Well, Pete Brown, your new book, Craft It, An Argument. What was such a big deal about Beavertown a few years ago?
Wasn't
the owner of Beavertown, as an American, wasn't his dad someone from like Led Zeppelin or something?
The guy who sets up Beavertown, his dad is Robert Plant out of Led Zeppelin, which is pretty damn cool. I've had dinner with Robert Plant as a result of being a beer writer who lives near Beavertown. I can't tell you how cool that is. And I'm not even a Led Zepp fan, and I still thought he was cool. In 2018, they sold out. They sold a 49% stake to Heineken, and there was wailing and gnashing of teeth in the UK craft brewing scene. About a month later, another brewer we've got called Four Pure sold 100% to Lion Nathan, and no one gave a crap. There was no outcry whatsoever, and Beavertown and Four Pure brew pretty similar beers of a similar style and a similar level of quality. I think they're both really great brewers, and the Beavertown thing was like, this is really weird. This is really, there's a lot of pain here that's not just about these guys have sold out. That people felt personally betrayed, and my background is in brand management, and I'd like to be provocative, and part of my thing was Beavertown had built a really cool brand. They had these kind of aliens, so these skeletons in spacesuits firing ray guns at hop monsters and stuff, and they put these things upon big murals at beer festivals. They were cool, and the guy who set it up was Robert Plant's son. And then, so then when they sold to Heineken, it was kind of like, oh my God, not you as well. I feel totally betrayed. And so I use that as the forward to the book. For people who maybe don't understand the emotional investment in craft beer, to say this is how much people care, this is how passionate people are about this whole idea. Before I get into breaking down what this whole idea of craft is, this is how invested people are in it.
Well, that brings me back to maybe it was 8 or 9 years ago when Goose Island was sold, entirely to Anheuser-Busch. I remember that. Like craft beer bars, like the Blind Tiger in New York City, that I would take my lead from, said that they would no longer carry Goose Island because it wasn't craft, it wasn't independently owned. And over the years, I tried to follow that when I had my pub as well. But it did get kind of confusing after a while. I remember a few years ago, Wicked Weed was also acquired by AB InBev. And you're right, there wasn't the same reaction. But I still felt like this loyalty to that concept of this independently owned craft beer. Is it the same in England? Or is it more passionate?
It's 100% the same in England. And I try to break out, I try to put a wedge between ideas of craft and ideas of independence, because I believe that an independent brewing sector is really important, not just for craft beer and craft beer drinkers, but for the whole market. The independent sector is the bit that gives its dynamism, its forward motion. The whole of beer is better since we had a thriving, healthy, independent sector, because it gets everyone else to buck their ideas up and to do things better. But independence is not the same thing as craft. There's a big overlap, sure. But when you look at this broader thing about what it means to be a craftsperson, if you're a furniture maker or a stained glass window maker or any of these other kind of classic traditional crafts, independence never comes into it. It's never mentioned in any discussion of craft outside beer, because craftspeople always had wealthy patrons. If you're going to allow someone to use the best ingredients and give them really good equipment and allow them the liberty to sit and create things in the way that they want to do rather than just some industrial crap, then there's got to be some money there from somewhere.
And then that brings us to when the craft beer was being first rolled out. What's the price pressure that's on selling in a supermarket, for example, versus selling independently?
I mean, this has just been happening in the last 24 hours here in the UK. This is a debate that rears its head every few weeks. And I have to confess to a terrible crime here, which is that in the height of lockdown, after most of my income dried up, there was a thing online saying, hey, look, here are some Goose Island beers, that they're barrel-aged beers in Tesco being sold for rock-bottom prices. This is an absolute disgrace. This is kind of undercutting independent brewers who can't afford to compete on this scale. Craft beer in supermarkets is wrong. And I was on Twitter going, you're absolutely right, it's terrible. Then I was straight onto Tesco.com trying to order some of these beers at these rock-bottom prices because I'm a hypocrite. And it's like, if these beers are that cheap, I'm going to buy them. So it's a really, really difficult thing to reconcile as a beer lover. There's no proof either way on this. But the best interpretation of this, the most optimistic interpretation of this, is that if someone wants to sell their beers in supermarkets and play the volume game rather than the margin game, maybe that introduces more new people to craft beer who otherwise wouldn't have got into it. And then maybe they're going to go to a bottle shop and buy some of the brands that they can't get in the supermarket. I hope that's true. I have no evidence that it is.
You know what happened? It's happened in the last 10 years in the coffee trade. When Starbucks first started spreading in the United States, there was a similar outcry against it by independent businesses. But what I feel happened with Starbucks is that it created the premium coffee category. And now where we live in New York City, there's so many independent coffee chains that are all thriving, partly because they can charge the Starbucks price.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's the case in a lot of businesses. And the thing is, some people are going to feel that effect, and other people are going to say, "Well, we had a really great bottle shop business until these guys went to the supermarket. They were our biggest selling brands, and then we lost a load of business." So I think there is evidence of it working both ways. But I would suggest overall that it works the way that you're saying, that it helps establish a more premium category in things. And premiumization is a constant in marketing. It's been happening for 40, 50 years now. There's always something new that's premium. And people selfishly are always looking to buy something slightly cooler than what the other guys are buying. Everyone wants to feel that they're a bit more discerning than everybody else. And so if you introduce craft beer to this broader audience or premium coffee, there's going to be hopefully enough people who feel that to move on and to learn more and to pay a bit more for something better.
And Stephen, going back to that, so for you and things that you've covered, I remember thinking that the best beer was on draft or in a nice bottle. How did you see the transition to really good beer going into cans?
Well, it's kind of funny, Jimmy. Being a Canadian, we saw that actually pre-Oscar Blues. The Oscar Blues guys always like to say they were the canned beer revolutionaries. But in actual fact, craft beer out in Western Canada was going into cans long before it was for Oscar Blues. And in fact, the company that created Oscar Blues micro canning machine is a Canadian company. So it wasn't such a heresy. In Western Canada back then, 70% of the beer that was sold was being sold in cans. So if craft brewers wanted to compete, they had no choice. They had to go into cans early, and they did. Now, going back even earlier, I remember talking to some guys from Pilsner Urquell back in the early 1990s when they were introducing the can into Canada, the 500 milliliter can of Pilsner. And I said, so are you going to take this into the United States? And they said, absolutely not. They said the U.S. would never accept a premium beer in a can. So there was a kind of a, even from the big guys, there was this perception that there's a different attitude toward cans and premium beers in Canada than there was in the United States. So it was a smoother transition here. I say right now I probably buy 60, 70, maybe 75% of all my beer in cans just because that's the way that it's sold. It's one of those new realities of life.
Yeah, and it kept a lot of bottle shops and breweries going in the States during this quarantine for sure. Hey, BR, so we've had a lot of conversations about good beer, going back to the Good Beer Seal in New York in 2009. Remember what are some things that you've taken from it and that you'd like to add to this conversation?
Well, I mean, I think just going back to what Stephen was saying on the cans in the U.S., I mean, we have seen, as recently as maybe even a year ago, pushback from our more traditional German brewers who are like, oh, absolutely, we would not put beer in a can because even there it's considered kind of down market. It's a mass produced beer that's in cans that, you pick up at the train station or something, whereas other countries were much more open to it earlier on. So much of my beer now is also bought in cans. I mean, ease of transport, especially in the summer, but trying to head out to a park or something. But in terms of good beer and craft, I mean, it is a very difficult thing to define, because you can talk about an old brewery that's been doing something for many years that has been crafting it for many years, other breweries that are much more modernized, fairly automated, but still have passion behind it and create a craft product, even though, it might, as Pete was saying, when your sparge arm is mechanical and things, it's, if you're just pushing buttons into your computer, but making quality product because there's a passion behind it.
And Pete, so back to your book, do you think that craft beer as a term is should no longer be used? Where does your book end up? Because I only got to page 88, honestly.
Okay, so I'm going to do spoilers. So it goes all around this whole idea of craft, going back to the arts and crafts movement, then arrives back at the start of lockdown with all these ideas in my head and looking at beer from this perspective. And where I get to, I think, is that we should talk about and cherish and support independent brewing, and we should call it that. But then we should repurpose the term craft and bring it back to what it's meant to be about. And the thing about that is, I think the reason people want a definition, And if you'll permit me, Americans, even more than we do, love to categorize things and split things down and measure them. Whenever I watch American sports, I'm amazed about all the stats that run along the bottom of the screen. Yeah, you get that way more than we're catching up. We're getting more like you. But you really kind of notice that. And people want a definition of craft beer that's measurable, so that they can say brewery A is a craft beer, brewery B is not a craft beer. And it's on the margins where we can go, right, is this beer craft or not? Well, does it meet these criteria or not? We can measure them. We can measure what they do. We can measure what percentage of stake is owned by a big business. We can measure how much barrelage there is. No, it's not a craft beer. And the thing about craft in its broader sense is that it rejects this notion of craft, this idea of craft. It rejects precise measurement. Precise measurement is the antithesis of what craft is really about. When you talk to craftspeople, they don't use measuring tools. They do everything by hand and eye. When you ask a craftsperson how they do what they do, they can't tell you. They can't explain it because it's all about this idea of inherent skill, innate skill that's been built up over years. And so in a way, if we want to talk about craft beer, we're wrong to ask for a measurable definition. And so I get to this kind of fairly arch place where I'm saying it is possible to define craft beer, but not in a way that you can measure. And knowing that that's going to wind a lot of people up, it's like, well, what's the point of having a definition if you can't measure it? Well, you know, it describes what it is. And that's enough. And that's where I get to as a new definition of craft, which is about the job satisfaction that people get from doing it, the motivation for why they're doing it. And you can't measure it. And frankly, I don't care that you can't measure it.
Stephen, you're interviewing Pete for an article. What's the question you're going to ask him first?
It's funny because I was just looking over at the Ikanuki Godspeed can that is sitting on my desk beside me, and I noticed not for the first time there the slogan of the brewery, and it's called "Made with Struggle and Love." And I'm thinking, hey, what do you think that is a definition of craft?
Perfect.
That's not a bad definition, actually.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. And then BR, in your portfolio, you know, like Godspeed's, you know, from that Quebec group, like Due to CL, are there certain places where this ethos of, you know, hard work and craftsmanship is still thriving?
I think it's thriving everywhere, and I think there's always going to be new people who are inspired to take it up, even more so. You know, now it's coming from people who are into the craft scene. It's not so much homebrewers who are brewing something that they weren't able to get previously and then became proficient at it and thought, hey, I'm going to start a brewery. I mean, it's now it seems like it's a mix of people who love craft beer, whatever the definition of that is, but to them, what they feel craft beer is, and people who are homebrewers as well. But I think there's passion and all around the world. And I don't see it stopping anytime soon because it's always evolving. People are always going to be either interested in something new and new ingredients, or they're going to go back to the classics and then rediscover them, or perhaps discover them for the first time and then realize, oh, you know, this is where this style comes from. And now I'm learning more about the basis of it. But I think it's a very fruitful time right now with just so many boundaries that people are willing to go past, sometimes with success and sometimes not. But also people willing to respect tradition. And I think it's a lot of things are available to everyone, whatever styles you're into.
And Steve's drinking Godspeed from Toronto. What are you drinking today, BR, or will you be drinking?
Right now I'm drinking water, because if I were to have a beer right now, I'd fall asleep. One beer that's been in our fridge that we've really enjoyed locally is cans of the Fifth Hammer Piñata Bebop, which is one of their sours. It's with blood orange and pineapple. But unlike a lot of the sour fruit beers that I find that we have domestically, this one's like nice and balanced with just sort of, it's very refreshing for summer. Fruity with a nice balancing acidity without being, you know, hit you over the head.
Great. And back to Pete. So Pete, when Beavertown sold, who are some of the diehards in the UK, whether bottle shops or breweries, that led the outrage?
Oh, I don't want to name names.
But you do in the book.
Yeah, I think some of them. So, BrewDog, who are Now the 19th largest brewing concern in the world, according to some figures, but still fully independent. So there's a conundrum for you. They immediately announced that they weren't going to be stocking Beavertown in their bars anymore. And BrewDog have laid out their stall about being about independence, so they had to do that. And then you get small independent bottle shops. I mean, there's a great, wonderful bottle shop in South London called Hot Burns and Black, and their proposition is that they sell beers from small independent breweries. So they had to sell, they had to stop selling Beavertown on the day that it announced its sale. And it grieved them massively that they had to do this. They love the people at Beavertown. They weren't abusive when they announced this. They said, we love you guys, but we can only sell your beers. This is a real blow to us because you account for about 10% of our business. And my thing is, if you've got skin in the game and you set up your stall as being all about small and independent, you get the right to criticize people like Beavertown who sell a stake in the business to a major. If you're some keyboard warrior sitting in an office on your Apple Mac just tweeting how disgusting Beavertown are in your coffee break, then your opinion is not valid because you're taking the corporate money as well, and you've not put everything on the line, you've not sacrificed everything to build up this brewery from nothing. And my view is you don't get an opinion on this.
I'm gonna jump in there, Pete, because I have a bit of an issue with what you just said, because so many craft breweries they build their business on this idea that we're not the big guys, we're your community, support local, support our local independent business, and they develop a relationship with the consumer. So the beer drinker is now drinking more than just a beer; they're drinking an ethos. They're drinking this friendship they have with this brewery. They go to the brewery tap room. They go and they buy, they pay extra for special releases, all this kind of stuff. And then that same brewery turns around and takes some big brewery money and says, oh no, but everything's going to be the same. I mean, that's going to get emotional.
Yeah, it is. It is. It absolutely is. So I understand where the emotion comes from. And it is one of those conversations that's been going on ever since Goose Island sold. And it will continue and it won't be solved. Oh, God, what was I going to say? I'll have to cut something out. Sorry, I completely lost my train of thought there. But you know, it's an emotive issue. It's an emotive issue. And it becomes separated from the beer itself. You get these people saying, well, now it's going to be just terrible, bland corporate beer. They're going to cut all the expenses and things like that. So, well, at least wait and let them do that first. You can't assume that's going to happen. But I do, when I'm in my more dispassionate moments, I do find it intellectually fascinating how strong these feelings are and how much beer is a cultural product.
And Pete, you've really got your hands in so many different aspects of craft beer. A couple of years ago, when we first had you on the show, you introduced me to some New York-based craft beer exporters. How do you work in the field? Because you're more than just a writer.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. It's very tricky because I would love to be just a writer. I would love that more than anything. But there isn't enough money to pay my mortgage in beer writing. So I occasionally do consultancy. I have a rule of my own. So there are people who would strike me off the artistic roll call for even speaking to big brewers and so on. My rule is that I never work with someone who I then also write about. So I don't help someone develop a new beer and then go, hey, there's this great new beer. So I do a bit of business side. That's my background. My background is in advertising, marketing, consultancy, and so on. That tends to be for the bigger guys, and that's cool because I don't really want to write about them. So then I split it and write about the smaller guys.
And then just back to the book, this ethos of craft, I mean, you did dive deep into, you know, theories of arts and crafts. Why did you quote Descartes, the philosopher? Because that's the moment where I was like, wow, maybe I should skip ahead from this.
Oh, go on. Wait, remind me of that quote.
Are you serious? Descartes, it's not to be or not to be, but I can't remember.
I totally can't remember it.
So you got to read the book, kids. That's the whole thing. Man, someone's gonna pull it up and know what it is. But you did dive in deep, you know, and I appreciated that. In the end, I'll tell you what I took away from it. I took away from that size doesn't matter. I think you did talk a lot about in the beginning that the original craft beer people probably never thought that craft would grow. And so that was probably why it was identified as small. Is that the case?
Yeah, they certainly couldn't have ever envisaged it was going to grow to be the multi-billion dollar business that it is, because they set up in opposition to that kind of business. And this is one of the biggest paradoxes in craft, is that, oh, let's create something small for people who don't want to buy beer off these really huge corporations. Oh, shit, there's an awful lot of people, way more than we thought, who don't want to buy beer off these big corporations. So what are we going to do? And it would be great if everyone said, okay, well, let's just all go hyper-local and let's all of us just buy beer from our local small brewery. But people don't want to do that, because some of these, I mean, they do, and they especially do in the States, where localism is becoming the big driving trend. But they also want to buy the best craft beer. They also want to buy their Trillium, and they want to buy their what used to be Beavertown and things like that, because these are the beers that are getting most hyped by people. And if you're a brewer working on a low margin business, and you go, well, actually, no, you're not allowed to buy our product because we don't want to sell too much of it, then that's not these people do have mortgages to pay and things like that as well.
Yeah, I just pulled up. One issue with having books on Kindle, first of all, I read a lot more on Kindle, but I can't always flip through the pages. It's a Descartes quote is, I think, therefore I am. So.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I wasn't getting your, I wasn't getting, I thought you were saying Dick Clark. Yeah, so, that's fantastic. That's brilliant. So Descartes, slightly less famous thing was about skill, and this is what sets us off on the whole craft project, really. He said that basically manual labor could also be done by machines and in some cases animals, so therefore that was a lower skill than labor that entirely relied on he said that was a lower skill than labor which relied on the human brain. So basically it created this whole system that we have still of white collar work being superior to blue collar work. And that set us on the path that we're on, where if you work in an office, you're better than a guy who works in a factory or a workshop or something like that. And it's actually not true. Because manual labor is not just manual labor. Manual labor involves an awful lot of mental skill as well. And we're wrong to decry it. And I think what we see now, I think part of the reason behind the rise of craft beer is it's part of a much bigger return to us wanting to do something with our hands. And if we can't do it with our hands ourselves, then we want to support other people who do. And that's going right back to your first question about handcrafted. We actually now start to think that there's a nobility in doing things in doing things by hand, because anyone can do stuff with a machine. And the connection between hand and head has become almost sacred. A lot of the stuff I was writing was talking about this reconnection of body and mind, the reconnection of hand and head, and the fact that my mental skill translates into something that I can create with my hands, and there's something meaningful there instead of just an Excel spreadsheet at the end of the day. And this is why, as well as craft beer, we're seeing a huge rise around the world in crafting, everything from macrame to making sourdough bread to carving wooden spoons. All these things are just in really huge growth, and craft beer is thriving within that context.
Yeah, I think that in some way we all know what craft means, and I really appreciate that you took the time to write this book. We could ask you a lot more questions. I mean, I feel like the origins of craft beer came about in the United States for one reason, because there were a couple giant breweries making crappy beer. And I'm sure that in England there were very different circumstances and Catskills and Cameron, but I think that's a whole nother show. And, and did you ever write a book about that, about Cameron and how Catskill was saved in England?
I covered it quite a lot in my first book, Man Walks Into a Pub, but I was covering it from a position that was fairly critical of Cameron at the time, which I've kind of rode back from quite a bit now. I have a lot more time for Cameron than I used to.
Well, that's good. And then the last thing is about diversity. I'm going to give a shout-out to Garrett Oliver's initiative, the Michael Jackson Foundation. I'm sure we're going to be doing a show with him this fall as well. But I think what his argument is that there's more room at the table, that craft beer is a type of industry where everyone should be represented, not just as consumers, but on the workforce. And I don't know if either one of you want to say anything, or if you're familiar with the new Michael Jackson Foundation. Stephen? Or
I saw the post that Garrett put up about that. I think it's a very, very good initiative. I'm firmly supporting it. I think that, you know, there's a lot about trying to sell to an audience that recognizes itself. And if your brewery is all white and male bros, then how are you going to sell to, you know, a black lesbian? How are you going to sell to a Latino? How are you going to sell to people who don't see themselves in your corporate layout? And I think that that's something that craft beer has to address. You know, in Toronto is much like New York, I think, that there's a diversity in this city that you can see. Like, I can walk out my front door and, you know, walk two blocks before I actually hear someone speaking English. I love that about my city. But I go to not all, but some craft beer events, and I wonder, where is this diversity? What happened to the rest of the city? Because it becomes quite a white bro thing, and I think that's just missing the mark, and I don't think that craft breweries are intentionally being exclusive. I think that this is just something that's happened without them really considering it, and the time is now to consider it and consider who you're trying to add to your potential market, and frankly, just being good human beings.
That's great.
I totally agree. I think there's, because I see parallels with the UK publishing industry as well, which, like craft beer, is far more white than the profile of the population in general. And half the task is exactly what the foundation is doing, and making sure, ensuring that brewers are not being exclusive, not being subconsciously or unintentionally racially profiling, or being racist in their hiring policies and in their inclusivity and in their diversity. But there's a circle here as well, which is that the industry also has to do a lot more to convince people of color and people from different ethnic backgrounds that this is relevant to them, because it's so white and bro culture at the moment. I think part of the problem is that a lot of people just think, well, that's not my scene, it's not relevant to me. And so that's a job that needs to be done as well.
That's great. And then, BR, anything else you want to say to wrap up the show?
No, I agree with what both Pete and Stephen have said about a diversity. I mean, it's, you know, like kind of attracts like. So whether it's in terms of hiring or, you know, festivals, whether it's unintentional or not, there definitely has to be more focus and more thought put into whether it's the marketing, whether it's hiring. You know, I remember being at a beer festival in Belgium, you know, maybe about 10 years ago, and compared to beer festivals in the US, it was full of families. I mean, it was, you know, in terms of the demographics, there were grandparents, there was grandchildren. It was a very, I mean, this also speaks to drinking culture in the US compared to Europe, but it was a very welcoming scene. It wasn't a bunch of people trying to get drunk or a bunch of bros, you know, ticking off what they're, you know, wanted to, you know, in their, you know, their collections. And it was much, it seemed more welcoming to to people. And I think that that's what we need to do in the beer industry is there's more and more women that have been able to join. There's still some misogyny and that certainly hasn't gone away. But we need to be more inclusive ethnically and racially as well, because it is a bro culture. It really still is. And that doesn't make it easier for people who want to get into the scene because they might find it too cliquish as opposed to wanting to enjoy a good product.
All right. Well, this has been a really great show. It's Stephen Beaumont, a writer from Toronto, B.R. Royer from Shelton Brothers, and Pete Brown. Pete, one more time, tell us the name of your new book.
It's called Craft an Argument, and it is out on Amazon right now.
And I'm going to call this episode Craft with C-R-A-E-F-T, Craft, and the title is going to be Size Doesn't Matter. So
excellent.
Take that with you, boys. So thanks, everyone, for joining me. Big shout-out to our producer, Dylan Hoyer, our head engineer, Matt Patterson. Thanks to Steve, BR, and Pete. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us here on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.